Blog Talk Radio.
Masonic Home Companion. I hope you've had a very pleasant week. Nothing like being introduced to a radio program, listening to music written by one of our brethren, James Oliver, and performed by another very famous, Louis Armstrong. Of course, that's the West End Blues. And that recording is from 1924. I just think it's the most incredible way to start a conversation with all of you. I hope your week has been going well. Sit back in your most comfortable chair with your most comfortable beverage in your hand, and we'll have a conversation. Of course, as usual, I will likely prevail with all of the arguments and discussion points, but I hope at the end of the hour with you that you've come away with something meaningful. It perhaps challenges the little gray cells, as Pro would say. I'm broadcasting for the very first time remotely, and this is, of course, an experiment, and I'll be asking for various permissions because there are upcoming events in July, and I'm thinking that it might be a very opportune moment to use the internet to broadcast to brethren that may be congregating around Toronto. Who knows? Stranger things have happened. Today, of course, is the 3rd of June, 6012, Anno Lucas, and I hope you're all scurrying to make the best of the next 17 days as each day grows longer, coming toward summer solstice. That's, of course, when the sun reaches its furthest point north here in the northern hemisphere. So mark this on your calendar so you can be outside and in touch with the ethereal on June 20th at 7:09 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. I think you'll find this is going to be, according to the material that I have, the earliest winter since 1896, because it arrives at 6:12 a.m. on December 21st. So between the 20th of June and the 21st of December, the days become increasingly shorter. That concerned our ancients a lot more than it concerned us. Now, you're a hearty bunch, and I'm very, very happy to know that this type of format has appealed to a great many of you, listeners. But just to put it into some kind of context, around the number of countries in which Freemasonry is found is 164. Sorry, the number of the order collectively around the world, this is a breathtaking 5 million. Now in Canada, collectively, we have 1,600 lodges. The total number of us in this country is 180,000. Now, I would say that's fairly significant. The calculation on the numbers in England is 600,000, in Germany, 21,000, in Austria, 2,350, and in France, 84,000 of us. So you can begin to see that there is an interesting spread. In the United States, of course, the largest number of members in Freemasons' lodges are in Ohio, 220,000. And then California, I used to think California would have a significant amount, 188,000 brethren. Florida has 83,000. Michigan, 111,000. You can tell that Freemasonry and the Scottish Rite really took traction in the United States. And that's as much, I think, to do with the history and the development of North America as it does with the growth and expansion of Freemasonry. But I was listening of course, it's the Diamond Jubilee of our monarch. Whether you're a monarchist or not, Elizabeth has, I think, objectively served the role of queen in a way that we can all admire for her steadfastness. And she is, of course, a living symbol. And we can take issue with what that symbol means, but not with that, perhaps the fact that she is significant. One of the things you'll hear from her is that in order for an institution to exist, an institution as old as a monarchy. And I hope you're all paying attention and have sharpened your pencils to jot this one down. It's essential that it constantly keeps up with the times. But while it's doing that, that it remains, for all intents and purposes, very stable. That means the way that we present ourselves to one another and to our communities at large needs to remain the same, but the internal workings and how we go about our business needs to constantly be updated to remain current. That speaks to our sense of relevance. Now, too a lot, and I think perhaps too much, is being discussed about the need for change. And I think we're serious-minded fellows, and I think we need to come to a point where we can say collectively to one another that we've got that. We understand. It's not a need to change. It's a fact of acknowledging the fact that change occurs around us. It's not a matter of choice. What is a choice is how we define ourselves relative to that change. Fearful of it? It really makes ourselves seem weaker and less than what we would hope a distinguished order Freemasonry would be. We're not foolish people, though, but it's in making change and adapting, we need to be able to not necessarily be on the vanguard of everything, but once we see something that has gained some credibility, we need to be able to consider it. And of course, it comes as no surprise that through this medium, I'm speaking to you very current science. I'll be experimenting with online television, YouTube television very soon, so we'll be broadcasting through my own television network. As well, we'll try and keep up the radio because I'm nostalgic and I love this way of communicating with people. For those of you, when I was reminded this weekend, I promised to have a guest speaker, and I apologize to one and all. Guest speakers are lining up. The fact that I'm over here in Ottawa should tell you that I attended a Masonic educational event, the conference of 2012, I believe it's the first one that was happening, a credit to John Forster and a number of very dedicated fellows that worked with the chairman of Masonic Education. I would say the entire day was enormously successful because there was a granularity to the conversations and the lectures that were going on. And I think what piqued it for me, anyway, was to have Renee Rafferty talking to us again. She's an exceptional academic, I think, and kept us on the edge of our seats with information about the War of 1812 and some of the living habits, the context, the lives of people. She brought that alive for a great many of us. It strikes me as peculiar that we perhaps over the years have been rather superficial. I use that relatively. Superficial with our expectations toward education, spiritual and philosophical. We are now needing to realize that the social media, the internet, has given access to information so that collectively we can work together, but we can also, at our fingertips, have access to some of the finest minds and the most polished presentations. And I'm very committed, and I like to consider myself perhaps, if not a conservative, a Freemason, a neoconservative. But things like defining the landmarks raises in my mind an interesting discussion that I might have with you. In some jurisdictions, the landmarks are clearly defined. In here, though not as clear or distinct as in other areas, and it made me think, this is not a group here that overlooks or makes too many mistakes if you start to scratch the surface. It made me wonder if that general notion of landmarks gives us each an opportunity and perhaps an obligation to reason them through for ourselves. That we need to be able to understand what the landmarks are, but it's important not just to understand a list of them, but as I've said many times to you, I hope you don't go through a ritual and get all excitable about it and think that that's what Freemasonry is, the performance of behavior of a ritual, when you completely ignore the fact that somewhere along the line we have to understand the meaning of our philosophy, the meaning of our principles, and what the meaning says to us. To say that we go through the ritual, therefore we've got it. No, I don't. I think that's dismissive. I think that's dismissive, and perhaps takes me back to my original point that we were generous, and perhaps a bit superficial in the way we went about our business for a lot of good reasons, and I think it's again necessary for us if we're going to try and achieve the potential of an organization that's constantly evolving and keeping up with change, i.e. is staying relevant. And for the detractors out there, I would challenge you that there is a relevance today. That's different than it was in the past, but still current. And you know, some of you will recall that for years I've been saying that the time for Freemasonry has arrived on the planet, where we're looking for, we fought very hard to have a political, social structure where all people's rights, so the Americans are prone to say inalienable rights, are guaranteed, including the right to worship. And so we created a secular environment. And we see where these theistic theocracies occur. We still see them teetering into tremendous imbalance and conflict. So we paid our price. I don't think we should. There's hubris in my voice here. We paid our price hundreds of years ago in tragedy and bloodshed to learn these lessons. And it wasn't like we learned them quickly. We kept those battles raging until we said that we realized that trying to come up with solutions using that format was a fool's game. So we stopped. We stopped. And we came up with something called secularism. And we see now, after we've lived through it, we can all point fingers and say, yeah, it was better in the good old days. But that's again, sort of extrapolating from history the things that go along with our own theses. We take from history the arguments that agree with our own thoughts, rather than looking at things objectively, as if everybody contributed, everybody had something to do with the outcome. And so we all have responsibilities for the consequence. Now, I'm going to just move on a little bit, of course, give you a little bit of an idea of where that comes from philosophically. This isn't just spinning things off the top of our head. For those of you who might have slept through that introductory or second year or third year in philosophy class, or didn't have the perhaps the college or program that recognized how important philosophy is to the nature of our work, go and ask Wall Street. Sorry, that was being smug. That's like kicking somebody when they're down. That's not right. I'm going to talk to you about the supreme categorical imperative on the old and goldie. This is from, you can read about Immanuel Kant. He's a German philosopher, of course. His overarching principle, the criteria for all other ethical maxims, is what he calls the supreme categorical imperative. And at the first blush, it seems like a gussied up version of the old golden rule, which is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Only he says it in a little more, hear it for yourself. Act only according to that maxim whereby you can, at the same time, will that it should become a universal law. I like do unto others myself. But he couldn't help it. He was what he was. And he was speaking at a different time. But that action isn't like everybody's lined up in a totalitarian state. This isn't a bunch of troops all standing heels together, knees and back straight. It's not a specific action, but like honor thy father or eat your spinach. Instead, it provides an abstract principle for determining what specific actions are right and which are wrong. That's, of course, ethics. And both this abstract principle invokes the idea that all folks are as valuable as you and me, and so all should be treated morally the same as you and me, particularly me. Well, I meant you, of course. I always liked you best. So here's one you can put in your pocket. Do not do unto others as you would have others do unto you, because they may have different tastes. According to George Bernard Shaw. I'm going to skip through a little bit of history here for you, just to give you some background on this. Hinduism says in the 13th century, do not to others what you do not wish done to yourself. This is the whole Dharma. Heed it well. That's from the Mahabharata, Judaism from the 13th century. What is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. That is the entire Torah. The rest is commentary. Go learn it. That's from the Babylonian Talmud. Zoroastrianism, 12th century. Human nature is good only when it does not do unto another whatever is not good for its own self. And that's from the Dadistan Idenik in the 6th century. Buddhism. Hurt not others in ways that you yourself would find hurtful. And that's from the Tibetan Dhammapada. Confucianism in the 6th century. Do not do to others what you do not want done to yourself. Confucian. Islam from 7th century AD. No one of you is a believer until you desire for another that which you desire for yourself. That's from the Sunnah. From the Hadith. In the Baha'i 19th century, ascribe not to any soul that which thou wouldst not have ascribed to thee, and say not that which thou dost not. This is my command unto thee, do thou observe it. Baha'u'llah, the Hidden Words. And from Sopranoism, 21st century, whack the next guy with the same respect you'd like to be whacked with, you know? There you have it. I think we've got the message. So, you can walk away today, and when the young upstarts and people that are talking through the top of their head are just carrying on about the essentials, that flows from utilitarianism, by the way. So you'll at least have a retort, a bit of support for your position. Let's say that. I'll briefly talk to you, give you a little bit of, I think you'll find this an interesting tidbit. When you're sitting back glazed-eyed, looking at the symbols on the wall, of course, I think that they're just, there's not enough of them. Of course, you know, I might like the Baroque style watch better, and I guess it's just my nature. I just look at the walls and I think these walls should be speaking to us. And, well, there's one message on the wall, and I'm thinking, well, what gives you the idea that the one message is the message, or it's the important message, or the essential message? There's hundreds of messages. There's many messages. Shouldn't I have that selection? Shouldn't I see a buffet when I go into a lodge? And I don't mean something like spray painting the side of a subway car. Here's a little bit of a kick up on the dog days. Something that I think you'll have some bearing. And this is from reading from the 1866 version of Holmes' Apocryphal New Testament, Ancient Mysteries, The Mysteries of Freemasonry, or an exposition on the religious dogmas and customs, just in case you lost your copy. I'll take notice some notice of what Abbé Pluche says of the dog days. I'm going to talk to you about the dog days. According to our author, the rising of the dog star, you'll remember we covered that a little while ago, was generally accompanied with what the Egyptians called the Etesian northern wind that continued to blow for about 40 days in succession. When this wind failed to occur at this time, or it was too light to be of use in causing the swelling of the Nile to be a sufficient height, a general sadness of the people ensued. The probability, therefore, is that while the inhabitants remained idle on the high ground, watching the progress of the inundation, these 40 days were passed very much in fasting and other acts of devotion to gain the favor of the gods in this respect. Indeed, the author relates a story that prevailed among the Cretans that corroborates this opinion, which is that through the displeasure of the gods, this wind was not permitted to blow for a considerable time. But after repeated sacrifices, the gods at length granted the return of the Etesian wind and its constant blowing during the 40 days that followed the rising of the dog star, called the dog days, which again brought abundance upon the earth. So we're thinking about a time after the dog days. The people, he says in another place, were born to observe the dog days. So the dog days, according to Volney, come from around the end of July during all the month of August and half of September. The winds in Egypt remain constantly in the north and are moderate, brisker in the day, however, and weaker at night. The dog days in calendars calculated for North America are generally noted as commencing on the 30th of July and ending on the 10th of September, making 42 days. It is highly probable that the Roman Catholic Lent has grown out of this ancient custom in regard to dog days, accommodated, however, in respect to the time of its observance, to the circumstances of countries differently situated to that of Egypt. Such an essential change in the usual habit of living is, no doubt, very detrimental to health, and probably causes the premature death of thousands annually. The requirement of abstinence from meat on Fridays and Saturdays is founded upon the same principle. A breach of this rule of the political religious church of Rome is placed in the list of damning sins, and a ritual issued even under the reign of the Emperor Napoleon, with his signature attached, ordering its observance by all Catholics through his dominions. Thus the fastings and mortifications originally got up to appease the fickle and vindictive gods of paganism have, without the least propriety or reason, being incorporated into the systems of some sects of professed Christians. In Abbé Pluche's account of Egypt, I will add a few extracts from a recent and valuable book entitled A View of Ancient and Modern Egypt by the Reverend Michael Russell, LLD. We're going to come back to Mike's work at another time. So when you think about the dog days of summer, remember, it still has prevalence, has a bearing on Osiris, the dog star. And when you look at the east, what do you see? The star? Some secret, such a secret, who knows? 5 million of us? How many of us know this? Well, I guess we've all lost our copy of books from the 19th century. Now, that said, I had a hard time listening to some, you know, it sort of skips, my brain does it sort of skips off the grooves. Some of you out there would be old enough to remember 45s and 78s and LPs. And, you know, when you banged into the equipment, it would skip. The needle would skip. And I hear now the high fidelity material is coming back, so I'll have to dust off my system deck and get my LPs out again. But the thinking here was that, you know, we take good men and make them better. Again, a concept I find remarkably bumper stickerish. Not to say bumper stickers don't, you know, if you're not behind me, stand in front of me, and it's all good. But I think there's surely this needs to be something a little more than that. Surely just a little bit. Particularly if it's to inspire the likes of you. You're not foolish. You're not easily swayed. You're not going to follow somebody else's opinions unless you've reasoned it through and arrived at it. At a sense that it's something that can be useful and meaningful. So, and I can't imagine everybody jumping at the opportunity of a simple slogan, unless you begin to think about what the message is, what's this process mean, and in all its variations. Men of conscience will probably come up with a deeper or appreciative understanding of that simple phrase. It's, I guess you could say to me equally, a do unto others could fit on a bumper sticker, couldn't you? Of course you could. Of course you could. And you'd be right. I never claimed to be right. We're reading this stuff so long, I think it's, what am I now, a skeptic? And I say, I don't, you know, you're right. You're probably right, but there's a lot of other information out there. The counter point of view and my own point of view, and help me to understand this without necessarily doing it through conflict. We get into an argument, you and I, over the small points or big points, simply distracts from the decisions that we have to make. And it makes me worry that the thinking is, I'll go along with your idea because of the volume of your personality. Or no, I won't insult you and think that physical size would sway my opinion anymore, because that doesn't. You'd probably have to shoot me twice. The first time I wouldn't give a crap. If that's all you've got to do to make your argument is pretty darn weak. The moment you figure that out, all of a sudden you start to have a really interesting grasp of the world around us, I think. And if 1,000 people say something that's equally idiotic, it still doesn't make you wrong. But this is where your principles and ethics are essential. This isn't stroking your own ego. I like it, I'm right, because it's my thought and everybody else is wrong because I disagree. Don't you wish it was that simple? Because the other 7 billion have the same approach to life. But you and I, we are galvanized by our adherence to certain principles that we hold dear. So remember, I want to bring you to some of the, I think, really interesting lessons on development. Things that perhaps my grandfather or father, or your grandfather or father, or parents or teachers, forgot to tell you. Now, this is from the writings of Michel Ecrem de Montaigne. He was born in 1533 and he died in 1592. So he started writing essays. He wrote an essay and then he rewrote it and he added to it and he rewrote it and he added, and he wrote one essay. Now, at the time, it was scandalous for anybody to write about his opinions and his ideas. So that, and you can imagine, today we take a lot of this for granted. Again, probably because we're not really that careful as students of history. Different times, writing about yourself and your own preferences was not considered flattering or purposeful, and he was criticized for it. But what he started to do was write about how to live a good life and wrote down his opinions. And you've heard over the weeks, we've talked about different versions of them. How to live, wake up from the sleep of habit. And last week, we talked about how to live, guard your humanity. So it wasn't like he was a frivolous man, but you imagine he was living in France at a time of major wars. He was in danger constantly, danger that I would find unimaginable, and to tolerate and still come up with this kind of delicacy of thinking. So he published these essays in 1580, and they became much more popular than he ever imagined, and so much so that the French king, Henry III, enjoyed them. And Henry was king, the emperor of France, between December 13th, 1553, and he passed away on 14th of May of 1610, of course. So this is, again, we're referring to his work. And this is how to live, do something no one has done before. See, he was always copying, and Montaigne was always fooling around with, after the first crop of essays was published, and he went to, you know, it happened because we had a printing press that was accessible. Probably, you would think about it, most of the major reforms of the world are because of access to a printer who has the temerity or courage to print the quotes or verses material, the material that's going to challenge the status quo. And that he did. A local a Bordeaux publisher handled his works. You even know his name. Simon Melange. He was an interesting choice because he'd been only in the city for a few years. So, you know, in Bordeaux, he's probably taking on as much work as he possibly could. That would make sense. You and I would do that. You know, we're new in town. The old established boys would have their corner of the market, Sona. And he had been only established just about as long as Montaigne had been writing. And he would have had a little more problem finding somebody in Paris to deal with, but the value of the work like the essays would not have escaped them, surely. But even in this first edition, it was slotted neatly into the established marketing genre of classical miscellanies, and commonplace books. But Montaigne insisted on staying with a local man rather than going off to the big city because of a personal connection, or as a matter of Gascon principle. First version of his book was quite different. And remember, we're talking about do something, how to live right, do something no one has done before. Yet they were already suffused. Some of them even kept quiet, even kept to their supposed point. The first version of his book was quite different from the one usually read now. It filled only two fairly small volumes. And although the apology was already outsized, most chapters remained relatively simple. They often oscillated between rival points of view, but they did not wash around like vast turbulent rivers or fan out into deltas, as later essays did. Some of them even kept to their supposed point. My goodness, not that I would ever stray. Or, as I want to kneecap myself for thinking, there I digress, a term I wish I'd never heard it once. Some of them even kept to their supposed point. Yet they were already suffused with Montaigne's curious questioning, relentless personality, and they often opened by puzzles or quirks in human behavior. Contemporary readers had an eye for quality. The work at once found an enthusiastic audience. His first edition was probably small, probably 500 or 600 copies, and it soon sold out. 2 years later, he issued another edition with a few changes. 5 years later, in 1587, this edition was revised, again, and republished in Paris by Jean Richer. But now it had become the fashionable reading for the French nobility of the early 1580s. So here I am, subversive as I am, exposing you to material that was all the rage for French nobility in terms of development. Was there an audience? Well, we'd like to think that these were people that were the most well-educated, the people that could afford tutors for their children. We can hate perhaps the outcome now that we know things have been smuggled with our 20-30 hindsight and point figures, but at the time, this is still the time when people in my clan, people like me and my ancestors, were scrambling for existence, trying not to starve. But not everybody in the world, rightfully so, was in the same boat. And I wouldn't wish that boat on anybody, to tell you the truth. But among its admirers, as I said earlier, was Henry III himself. When he traveled through Paris later, Montaigne, in 1580, he presented the king with a copy, as was conventional. Henry told him he liked the book, to which Montaigne is said to have replied, "Sir, then your majesty must like me, because, as he always maintained, he and his book were the same." Upstart. Let's get him out there, fire him. Nobody should be that comfortable. This, in fact, should have been an obstacle to his success by writing so openly about his everyday observations and inner life. Montaigne was breaking a taboo. "You were not supposed to record yourself in a book, only your great deeds, if you had any." What's that like saying? I'm going to brag, but I'm going to be humble. It's like this guy that I worked for a few years ago. I mean, he started off his comments to me as, "No offense intended." And then he would say those vulgar crap. It was one of those like, oh, who could take offense with that? Do you mind if I get up and smack you in my chair? And no, you can't get away with that crap. It was astounding. It wasn't even as if I was offended when I heard him saying it. It was like, you've got to be kidding. I am. I've seen too much. You have to. You see all this coming. And remember, I learned these lessons at the looking up at these old farmers in Prince Edward Island. These well-educated men, you can get them talking. They like to talk. Son of a gun. There's a lot of people that like to talk. Give them a little encouragement, blah, blah, blah. Of course, not me. And not you. I always remember, I always liked you best. Then, in fact, this should have been an obstacle. He was breaking taboos. The few Renaissance autobiographies so far written, such as that of Benvenuto Cellini's Vita Sua, V-I-T-A-S-U-A, for those so inclined, have been left unpublished largely for this reason. St. Augustine had written about himself. Now, there's a serious read for those of you who may have skipped that part of your development. Really brilliant. But as a spiritual exercise and to document a search for God, not to celebrate the wonders of being Augustine. Montaigne did celebrate being Montaigne, and this disturbed some readers. The classical scholar Joseph Justus Scaliger was especially annoyed about Montaigne's revelation in his later edition in 1588 that he preferred white wine to red. Actually, Scaliger was oversimplifying, because Montaigne tells us that he changed the taste from red to white, then back to red, then to white again. Heresy, heresy. Pierre Dupuy, another scholar, said, "Who the hell wants to know what he liked?" Naturally, it annoyed Pascal and Malebranche too. Malebranche called it effrontery, and Pascal thought Montaigne should have been told to stop. Don't do that. Screw you. We don't do that here. I love this. Only with the coming of Romanticism was Montaigne's openness about himself truly appreciated. Not only, but it was loved. So, in the closing of this hour with you, I'm going to talk a bit about that opportunity, the opportunities that are waiting. His time came with Romanticism, and that's a period that I'll leave you to explore. And if you're thinking this is something frilly or something frivolous, you'd be, I think, perhaps surprised, pleasantly surprised, at what you'll find that Romanticism did for our culture. The English critic Mark Patterson wrote in 1856 that Montaigne's supposed egotism made him come as vividly to life on the page as a character in a novel. And Bayle Saint-Jean observed that all true relishers of Montaigne loved his inconsequential twaddling because it made his character real and enabled readers to find themselves in him. It's like saying that we all do. We all have inconsequential twaddling. It's what allows us to stumble around and eventually define who we are, or posture. Posture is so that we create a presence or an attitude to communicate something about our character and our intelligence and worth to other people around us. Interesting how we use perception. The Scottish critic John Sterling contrasted Montaigne's way of writing about himself with a more socially accepted tradition of memoirs by public figures, attending only to the boring din and whirl of external events. Yes, we could agree. Montaigne is real and is real. Is real. Authentic, I would say. One of the quests for Freemasonry. On that bumper sticker, to make good bracket authentic men better. Genuine. I would tell you, take authentic men and make them genuine. Even in his 1580 version, Montaigne was fascinated by this inner world. It was not in some adventure's late chapter, but in his first edition that he wrote, "I turn my gaze inward. I fix it there and I keep it busy. Everyone looks in front of him. As for me, I look inside of me. I have no business but with myself. I continually observe myself. I take stock of myself. I taste myself. I roll about in myself." The image is intensely physical. One sees Montaigne rolling about like a puppy in long grass. When he is not rolling, he folds. "I refold my gaze inward" would be a more literal translation of the first sentence of his passage. He seems constantly to turn back on himself, thickening and deepening, fold upon fold. What I say to you is that he's like you and I. The fold upon fold is what happens as we have more experience. Are we aware of everything throughout our whole life? Probably not, if we're honest with each other. But perhaps as we get a little more experience, we have a deepening vocabulary that allows us to articulate deeper thoughts, more abstract feeling. That the world takes on another dimension, the metaphysical, that we like to call it, things that aren't necessarily observable, the things that you and I as Freemasons search for to give meaning to the world around us, like axioms or principles or ethics. Can't see an ethic, but we see the behavior that becomes the consequences of a world that doesn't have ethics. Decisions where ethics are foremost, it seems to, whether we know the lesson or not, fit. It seems to be a taste that we enjoy, like we've never had that taste before. It seems right for good men. And for men of impoverished thinking, weak-minded, I shake my head. Have we ever been able to persuade? Well, I'd like to think perhaps that you and I can and do by our behavior, that we need to be able to have the courage and conviction of our beliefs so that when it's not warranted by the attitude of another fellow, that we're able to prevail and extend an ethical, principled attitude toward him. So how else is he going to learn if you and I sit back and only respond when we think that he's worth it? Good Lord, even the scriptures some of us have read about are full of these lessons. The story of the Good Samaritan isn't about a helpful guy, it's about a helpful pariah, somebody despised. What would we say homophobics would have a great time. That's despicable. You know, they're subhuman. Before that, what would they be? Lepers? Pick one. We'll come up with something. It seems like humanity always has to have something on the edge. These unusual value judgments that we make. So when the person's not worthy, I think that's the test. When the event doesn't add up to something that's comfortable and familiar, then we see humble men doing noble things. Any fool can do it when it's easy. I think it takes a Freemason to show the depth of his character. Otherwise, we see this drivel of constant excuse that we see in the world around us, reasons not to do something. And how do we exercise the rightness of that? The rightness of our thoughts. Now, let me talk to you a little bit about we're just interesting creatures on the face of the earth. And we pass on the lessons to the next generation, like somebody passed on the lessons to our generation. We're fortunate enough to have a lot of lessons. But remember what the great historian Margaret Campbell explained to us, we need to understand all of history, all of it, not just the parts that go along with what we want to, the argument or the point that we want to achieve. We constantly distill history so in a way that allows us to distort it. Revisionism is referred to in some areas. When she tells us, you know, this is the chair of history at Cambridge, Canadian, when she tells us that we can't learn from history unless we understand all of it, as Masons, above all, we need to know the good, the bad, the ugly of it. This isn't Pollyanna. The myths are there because they contain knowledge, but they're there in a context of real history, of real men using real ideas to try and do something. And has that something changed? Well, I think so. The continuity we've brought in here, a little bit of different history. And if you want to know the truth, I thought, well, how do we illustrate history so that it's not static for you? Well, of course, I've been talking about history, a different kind of history. And I want you to know that this isn't definitive. There are many, many different types of history, many different ways of looking at history and learning from it. So go and explore it. Conquest and battle. You know, that we have all this other information to teach us so much more about the quality of life and what life is like. And I think when we do that and learn about the what life was like in days gone by, that's an important connection. An important connection that connects you and I with our ancestors and can convey the essential lessons as we move forward like we're supposed to with Freemasons. So far here we've talked about the history of man illustrated in a curious link, the beverages we drank. Remember in the past we went from the Stone Age brew of honey, something getting fuzzy and you're drinking it anyway, the discovery of beer around 10,000 BCE in the Fertile Crescent, and followed about 870 BCE in Assyria with the fermenting the grape into wine, and then distillation of wine in Cordoba. The Arabic alchemists came up with that for us. Thank you very much. And even the word alcohol, the ancient word, alcohol. And that was around 970 CE. And then this distilling of beer around the 5th century, aquavita, or as the Gaelic, yuskabitha. The origin of the words whiskey, uska, I think that's how I said it. I used to know. And then, you know, where do you go? Sixes and nines of the cheap labor, sugar cane harvest, cheap labor, the stain on the human conscience of slavery that allowed the production and spread of rum. And then in the age of reason, go and Google that one. That was about the time that we We're talking about coffee, and we talked about that a little while ago, about how coffee houses, and I think and perhaps you did after you listened to it, may have influenced the kind of order that we have, the way that we function as an order. It wouldn't be at all unusual. And of course, coffee houses evolved. They were different, functioned differently in Britain and in France, where we have a lot of history. And now we're entertaining the notions of tea. So I'm going to pick this up around the popularity of tea, and then this is moving toward, you know, eventually the big mama of all beverages, Coca-Cola. But that's coming up. Tea's popularity continued in the prosperous Song Dynasty, and that was 960 to 1279. But it fell from official favor as China came under the rule of the Mongols during the 13th century. The Mongols were originally a nomadic pastoral people who tended herds of horses, camels, and sheep on the open steppes. Under Genghis Khan and his sons, they established the largest connected land empire in history. Really interesting fellow, this Genghis. He would not only tolerate, but he wanted to learn from the lessons of the faith of foreigners into his land. And as long as they didn't try and proselytize and change the faith of his people, he was interested in the variations. He handled the largest connected land empire in history, encompassing much of the Eurasian landmass from Hungary in the west to Korea in the east, and as far south as Vietnam. My, that's breathless. Fittingly for a nation of skilled horsemen, the traditional Mongol drink was kumis, made from churning and then fermenting mare's milk in a leather bag to transform the lactose sugars in the milk into alcohol. This explains why the Venetian traveler Marco Polo, who spent many years at the Chinese court during this period, made no mention of tea other than to note the tradition of the tea tribute to the emperor, though he did not remark that kumis was like white wine and very good to drink. Although he did remark that. China's new rulers showed no interest in the local drink and maintained their own cultural traditions. Kublai Khan, ruler of the east portion of the Mongol Empire, had grass from the steppes grown in the courtyards of his Chinese palace and drank kumis, specially prepared from the milk of white mares. To emphasize the extent and diversity of the Mongol Empire, Kublai's brother, Mangu Khan, installed a silver drinking fountain at the Mongol capital of Karakorum. Its four spouts dispensed rice beer from China, grape wine from Persia, mead from northern Eurasia, and kumis from Mongolia. My goodness, now there's a host. Tea was nowhere to be seen, but the sprawling empire symbolized by this fountain proved unsustainable and collapsed during the 14th century. Can you imagine the logistics? A renewed enthusiasm for drinking tea was then one way in which Chinese culture reasserted itself following the expulsion of the Mongols. The preparation and consumption of tea began to become increasingly elaborate. The meticulous attention to detail advocated by Lu Yu was revived and extended. Harking back to its religious roots, tea came to be seen as a form of spiritual as well as bodily refreshment. The idea of the tea ceremony was, however, taken to its greatest heights in Japan. Tea had been drunk in Japan as early as the 6th century, but in 1191, the latest Chinese knowledge about the growing, picking, preparation, and drinking of tea was brought into the country by a Buddhist monk named Issa, who wrote a book extolling tea's health benefits. When Japan's military ruler, or shogun, fell ill, Issa cured him with the help of some homegrown tea. The shogun became a strong advocate of the new drink, and its popularity spread from his court to the country as a whole. By the 14th century, tea had become widespread at every level in Japanese society. The full Japanese tea ceremony is an immensely intricate, almost mystical ritual that can take more than an hour. Merely to describe the steps of grinding the tea, boiling the water, mixing and stirring the tea is to overlook the significance of the particular form of the utensils, the order and the nature of their use. The water must be transferred from a specific kind of jar to the kettle using a delicate bamboo dipper. A special spoon is used to measure out the tea. There must be a special stirrer, a square silk cloth to wipe the jar and spoon, a rest for the kettle lid, and so on. All of these items are to be brought in by the host in the correct sequence and placed on the correct mats. Ideally, the host is even to gather the firewood himself, and the whole ceremony should take place in a tea house situated in an appropriately laid out garden. In the words of Japan's greatest tea master, Rikyu, who lived in the 17th century, if the tea and eating utensils are of bad taste, and if the natural layout and planting of the trees and rocks in the tea garden are unpleasing, then it is as well to go straight back home. Although incredibly formal, some of Rikyu's rules, such as the decree that the conversation was not to turn to worldly matters, are not so different from the unwritten rules that govern a ceremonious European tea dinner. The Japanese tea ceremony was the very pinnacle of tea culture. The result of taking a tea from Southern Asia, imbuing it with a diverse range of cultural and religious influences, and filtering it through hundreds of years of accumulated customs and ritual. Bring it all forward, brethren. I think we've done pretty much the same, haven't we? It's hard to ignore the fact that we've taken lessons and ideas handed to us through the ages, and we've added our culture, we've added the values, changing values of our society, and we've made things enormously different by virtue of the fact that we are who we are, and we're as distinct culturally from other nations as you and I are distinct and perhaps similar from one another. But we have a bond. It's important for us to embrace our history. It's important for us to exercise our principles, not just to talk about them in word, but to strengthen the meaning by applying them to ourselves. And I want to remind you where I think it's necessary to apply this most of all is with our Grand Lodge. If we have a sense that there is significant potential within the order, a potential, as I feel, that is still on the horizon, dependent very much on our understanding of history, then to reach that pinnacle, we are going to have to demonstrate, I think, more trust in one another. We want to be well informed, but we don't have the mechanics for that, to communicate all of the information to all of us at once. We don't have that. That's like our sense, having a sense of the ritual. That's what galvanizes us. We have to look at each other at the end of the day and say, I believe in you, and you believe in me, because we believe in these principles, and that makes us similar. And what more, I guess at the end of the day, is that not good enough? We're going to qualify us because we have the business. Don't let the business of our order, the finance of our order, interfere with that belief. Let the belief carry you forward, carry us forward, so that we can discover the potential. I hope you come back and join me next week on another version of Masonic Home Companion. It's always a distinct pleasure to be with you. And yes, we'll line up speakers, guest speakers, because I know that sooner or later you'll find me tedious. Thank you for joining me. Here's a little Diana Krall.
every time we say goodbye. I goodbye.